morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the City Council. We're glad that you're here. We've got a couple of very special proclamations before we begin the decision-making part of our morning. I'd like to recognize Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. Today we're going to celebrate Fair Housing Month, and we have a very special person with us. And before I read the proclamation, I'm going to ask Cassie L. Tom to come forward and to take her seat at the podium and bring her posters with her. And while you're sitting there, Cassie L., I'm going to read the city's proclamation, and then the mayor is going to recognize you to say whatever you would like on this important day. Mayor and colleagues, it's an honor this morning to share this proclamation with you, recognizing Fair Housing Month in Portland. And I would like to read the proclamation. Whereas our community is committed to equal opportunity and housing choice for all, and whereas the theme of this year's National Fair Housing Month is Live Free, and whereas the City of Portland and its partners are making a renewed effort to combat illegal discrimination and impediments to housing choice, and whereas the City Council adopted Portland's first ever Fair Housing Action Plan in September of 2011 and established a Fair Housing Advocacy Committee to oversee its implementation, and whereas we are working with tenant groups and landlords to improve the quality and the safety of rental apartments, and whereas illegal housing discrimination prevents people from living in homes of their choosing because of their race, their color, religion, sex, disability, family status, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, source of money, military status, gender identity, or history as a victim of domestic violence, and whereas under our federal fair housing laws, Oregon civil rights statutes, and Portland City Code, all of these forms of discrimination are illegal. And whereas 2012 marks the 44th anniversary of the signing of Title VIII of the Federal Civil Rights Act, the Federal Fair Housing Act, and the 24th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act amendments, now therefore I, Nick Fish, on behalf of our Mayor Sam Adams of the City of Portland, do hereby proclaim April 2012 to be Fair Housing Month in the City of Portland and to encourage all residents to take increased notice of housing conditions in their communities and and to join in the effort to promote fair housing for all. Mayor, can we have a round of applause?
Yeah.
Mayor Adams, we have a very special guest with us today, and her name is Cassie L. Tom. And she's here with her mom, Cynthia, and her grandmother, Margie. Have I embarrassed you both now? Okay. And we are very pleased that she's with us because she is the winner of this year's Fair Housing Council of Oregon Fair Housing Poster Contest. The theme of the contest this year was Fair Housing Welcomes Everyone Home. There were 335 entries received from young people all around the state. Cassie L's beautiful artwork makes her, and here's something to really note, a two-time winner. She also won the contest last year with the theme, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Cassie L is a seventh grader at the Metropolitan Learning Center in Portland. She loves photography and art and comes from a family full of artists. She won a $100 prize for her poster. Her work, along with other prize-winning posters, will be on display at the Beaverton City Library from April 14th to the 23rd. She brought some posters with her today, and she's here in part because her the nonprofit that provides the housing that she and her family lives in, which is one of our best partners, is REACH. And REACH is currently building veterans housing in South Waterfront. Would you please join me in welcoming and congratulating Cassie L. It's all yours.
Thank you. I'm not really sure what I should say.
Well, what can you show us? Can you hold up your poster? Did you bring an autographed poster for every member of the council?
I think so.
Okay. That is wonderful. You're very talented. Now, explain a little bit about what you drew there and why you drew it.
Well, basically when I took the Fair Housing Welcomes Everyone Home into consideration of a design, I was thinking people coming into a home, but showing their backs didn't look that friendly, so I had them kind of drawn as a community, kind of all playing outside, and everyone's kind of happy. So.
Well, you're very talented, and thank you, Commissioner Fish.
Can she come forward and give us all our copies, Mayor?
Please, that would be great. It would be our honor.
Or maybe we should come to you. Or you come to us. While she's doing it, I want to acknowledge that our great partners from the Fair Housing Council of Oregon are here, and I want to acknowledge Diane Hess, the education director.
It's very nice to
Alyssa Cudmore, the grants manager. Did Peggy make it? Peggy McGuire, excuse me. Peggy, thank you all for joining us today.
I just want to add, we have other copies of the poster on the desk there, so if anybody who's here for any reason wants to take one home with you, please do.
Pastor Dale, thank you to you and your family for honoring us today, and good luck next year.
Two-time winner, right?
Thank you. If I could have our Earth Week folks come forward. Would you like to say a few words, and then I'll read the proclamation?
Sure. Thank you for having us, and hello, everyone. And it's kind of fitting that we're sharing this time discussing, you know, with Cassie and Fair Housing Month, because for us, creating a week of events to celebrate the Earth has been a time of us exploring what it means to have a good home, what it means to, you know, live on this planet, to live in, you know, this country, in the state, in the city, in our university. So Earth Week at PSU is very much about living and, like I said, a good home. Do you guys want to say anything?
I just wanted to add that we were here last year, so this is an ongoing event that happens at PSU. It's one of the largest events that's held at the university. This is the 5th annual Earth Week celebration, and we're really proud of our work, especially this year, as Kirk mentioned, because we were able to expand the one-day celebration into a whole week of events. Where that enabled us to partner with many student groups and departments on campus. So it's basically opened up the concept of sustainability and environmentalism to any group on campus, not just the Environmental Club or the Sustainable Leaders Coalition, but really gave any student group a voice and an ability to show what environmentalism and caring for the Earth means to them.
And to share perspective and to have a more whole understanding of what community is.
Thank you for having us here today.
Yeah, well, this is especially important as the largest university in the state. You have that creates a big bully pulpit for you. And so the fact that you're in your fifth year of doing this, and just each year gets, you know, better and better. Thank you on behalf of a very grateful city. We appreciate it.
Could you each please tell me your name?
Kenzie.
Steven.
My name is Kirk.
Ina.
Jessica.
Let me read the proclamation. Whereas Earth Day is a global event now celebrated in more than 175 countries and by more than 500 million people every year, which promotes environmental awareness and the appreciation of the Earth's natural environment. And whereas Earth Day was first established on April 22nd, 1970, joining together more than 20 million Americans to celebrate one common cause, the preservation of our planet Earth. And whereas Portland State University's student-led annual festival, now in its fifth year, endeavors to educate, empower, and engage the community in environmental action. And whereas in celebration of this important day, Portland State University and the Environmental Club are putting on a week of dialogues, lectures, films, and workshops on topics of renewable technologies, ecological stewardship, and social justice. And whereas Earth Week will conclude with a community festival on Friday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the PSU park blocks. Hopefully it'll be good weather, but rain is part of the earth. Rain or shine, whereas this free public event will feature booths from PSU student groups and student community nonprofits, local food and arts vendors, interactive activities, demonstrations of sustainable technology, and a full day of excellent live music. And whereas Portland State University, the Environmental Club, invite the Portland community to join them in the celebration now, therefore I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim the week of April 16th through 20th, 2012, to be Portland State University Earth Week. Congratulations.
Can we take a photo with our poster and the council members?
Quick,
thank you.
We're going to run the numbers. And your proclamation. We got to raise it up a little bit. Why don't you hold the proclamation? Not that I'm going to choreograph. All right. Thank you all very much. Thanks for your work. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for your work.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any history majors here? Thank you very much
for
all your work. Really appreciate it.
And I have to leave early today, so.
The what?
I have to leave early today. Portland City Council, come to order. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. Can you please call the roll?
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Leonard. Fritz.
Here.
Adams.
Here. Quorum is present. We shall proceed. Can you please read the title for communications item number 351?
Request of Michael Krupp to address council to express concerns and to offer solutions.
Sorry, Commissioner Leonard couldn't be here once again. Good morning. Money is the collateral of bullies, a bully the fleshly incarnation of money. Sociopathy recapitulates etymology. If we do not look at our words, we shall incant a grisly future for ourselves. Capital means head, man means hand. How did man become a hand for money's machinations? Person means mask, corporate means in body. Corporate personhood is the presence of masked hoods with money and guns, and hearts by General Electric, who bring good things to life, like death. Somehow this abortion manages to speak with no mouth, its head flaming petrodollars. Like fire, it yells, more growth, more, more, gimme. Fire, like capitalism, is the living spite of dead patriarchs and will never be content until no contents are left to burn. If we do not carefully examine the way English is used as proxy slave master in the service of war, we will need the Rosetta sausage to decipher the cause of another dead planet. English is the two-cycle engine of the spoken word, the chipper shredder of world diplomacy. Now, with the help of the real 99%, we will replace the fallen trilateral umbrate of Adams, Leonard, and Shrunk, currently the Lou Gehrig's disease of city administration. The People's Peace Party will be elevated to occupy three seats on this council. They are of one mind, our mind, the 99%. Human priorities that serve all of us, safety for women and the vulnerable, shelter for the homeless. No longer will the rape publicans filibuster the Democrats as they attempt to pretend to differ in pursuit of our better interests. I find it oddly refreshing to see a newer, shinier, sexier lady billionaire who sells overpriced edibles to the fancy free promise to rescue us from the devastations of corporate money. I have been appointed by the Intrasolar family of still living planets to be the emergency global manager. We now have a state of Michael Law. I will defeat Goliath, parting the red tape to pull my people out of the sanguine sea in which they drown. Sneering misogynists will no longer butcher babies to better buy the batteries for their tin can robo hearts. Hey, chiefs of joint staff, I want to fight your best man, the witness to your marriage to Mars. Your pentagram or mine. Anytime, punks. Now your capitalism has become kaputalism. Just theater. Oh, there you are.
Thank Carla, you. Can you please read the title for communications, item number 352.
Request of Lisa Bates to address council regarding Portland Housing Bureau budget.
Good morning, Professor. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
Please begin.
Good morning. I'm here today to urge the council to fund the Portland Housing Bureau's request for $500,000 for homeownership, education,
and Professor, sorry to interrupt, but for the record, can you please give us your name?
Oh, yes, it's Lisa Bates, B-A-T-E-S. Thank you. As a member of the Board of Directors of the Portland Housing Center, I've been really privileged to hear many wonderful stories of families' pride at putting their kids to bed at their own home, of women gaining not only financial independence but self-confidence, and of older folks achieving a lifelong dream to be a homeowner. These stories show the individual impact of this funding, but I want to talk a little bit about the larger effects, about why the city should invest in these stories and these individuals. A thriving city is one that people both figuratively and literally buy into. Owning a home is a commitment to community and investment in the future. Owning a home gives people a tangible stake and an opportunity to benefit from economic development. And research shows that children of homeowners, even low-income children, have better health, do better in school, and future employment. Through funding homeownership education and counseling, the city can ensure access to homeownership is available to a broad spectrum of Portlanders, making these opportunities real for first-generation buyers, moderate-income households, women, and communities of color. The city has made commitments to ensuring that the benefits and burdens of Portland's growth are fairly shared, articulated in the Portland Plan, Strategy for Housing in Neighborhoods. And under Commissioner Fish's leadership, the Housing Bureau has articulated realizing fair housing goals and reducing racial disparities as a major commitment. And homeownership is a big component of that equity framework. Achieving these goals requires this investment in partnerships with nonprofits who work with underserved communities to achieve homeownership. For example, Portland's racial gap for homeownership is on the order of 25 percentage points. Communities of color haven't been served by the market alone, and the consequences are real. Displacement from newly revitalizing neighborhoods without gaining from rising home values. However, even at a time when the housing and job market have been turbulent, Portland's homeownership organizations have been able to support new buyers of color and other underserved populations. For example, in the past 5 years, the Portland Housing Center has provided service to 671 new homebuyers of color and 650 new female-headed household homebuyers.
650?
Yes. Oh,
that's great.
We've also heard a lot about the downsides of homeownership due to unsustainable and predatory practices. Obviously, foreclosures and bankruptcies hurt families, neighborhoods, and cities. But buyers who work with homeownership, education, and counseling have been assisted to getting good loans and maintaining their homes. The financial literacy and home buying education and counseling services offered by Portland's nonprofits are critical to promoting homeownership that's sustainable and allows families to build wealth. It actually serves as the first line in foreclosure prevention. It helps new buyers make the right choices at the right time. And likewise, I believe the right time for the city's investment in home buyer education is now, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate it very much. Carla, can you please read the item, Communications 353.
Request of Francis Capps and Matt Callanan to address council regarding SUN program at Buckman Arts Focus Elementary School.
Hi, welcome.
Hello. Thank you. My name is Matt Callanan. I am proudly a parent of a third grader and a kindergartner at Buckman Elementary School. I'm here to urge that there be no cuts to city pass-through funds to SUN, particularly for Buckman Elementary. Buckman is a modest school. It has many families in deep need, other families who struggle, and still other families of modest means. SUN does what it says it does. It uses the medium of school to unite neighborhoods by establishing relationships with all families as well as community business members, to draw on the strengths of some to serve the needs of others. So the support that is provided by you commissioners is not only appreciated by those families in need, but matched by those families and partners that have something to give. What I want to underscore is that those families in need are not in a position to accept that support directly from other families due to either logistics or pride. That is not a reality. And those families that appreciate Sun's services and want to support Sun by also supporting families in need cannot do so without the coordination of Sun. Sun brings together families suffering bouts of need with those families that are blessed with momentary ability to assist. Sun lives to its charter. It unites neighborhoods and it unites families. These families cannot unite themselves. If it is important to understand the programs and services that Sun directly provides or develops, then you'll see them listed on your sheet there. But what seems to be unappreciated here is the beneficial consequence of these services. Some time ago, I personally had established and administered a program such as Sun. And while delivering similar service to these was meaningful to those families, what was more impactful was what followed. Receiving the support provides a security to families, and that security has a direct correlation to a family's ability to provide for themselves. It is a real and inarguable fact that concern for a child's underserved well-being perpetuates a family's poverty status. Parents who are concerned for the well-being of their child will concede their own income-earning potential to address those family concerns themselves. On the other hand, when parents feel their child's well-being is being addressed, then they can focus on their employment obligations. That impacts the very poverty statistics that you are using to weigh this decision. Sun indeed has tipped the scales for these families, but without their thumb, the scale will tip back in a matter of a few short months, and the statistics will reveal such a few short years later. The statistics that you see today will not be sustained without the continued involvement of Sun. Please do not mistake this as a Habitat for Humanity type house where Sun rallied community to provide shelter for a needy family. In that scenario, Sun could move on and the house will still stand. This is not a house. Sun is a living coordination effort that took considerable time and resources to establish and nurture. While the school is a very effective medium to access families who both need and provide support, school is also an organic community of families that change every year, so these services are not sustainable without the ongoing coordination and direction from Sun. What took years to build would cease to exist within a semester and would take years and considerable cost to reestablish when the need for its return becomes again inarguable. Once the support and coordination is gone, so goes the well-being of the child. May I finish this paragraph?
Please. Thank you.
Once the support and coordination is gone, so goes the well-being of the child, then the income of the parent. Then you've got the poverty statistics right back to the starting point where they were years ago for Buckman, not to mention the lost pride and integrity of the affected families. I truly believe each of you is noble in your intentions, but do know that that is the decision you are truly contemplating. By halting funding to Sun at Buckman, each of you would personally assign Buckman the very consequences and eventual statistics that leaves you believing Buckman is not presently in need of Sun. This is an elementary school that already is only a half percentage point shy of being a Title I school and where over a third of the students are identified as at risk. If these statistics do not justify the need for Sun, then if you make the decision to not fund Sun at Buckman, you will see the consequential statistics certainly will.
Thank you for your testimony. Just we're in the process of putting together, or I'm in the process of putting together the mayor's proposal, so we appreciate the opportunity to hear from you. The commissioner reminds me that no particular program has yet been identified for cuts within the Sun School system. Yeah. So thank you for
Understood.
Your time. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for your time.
All right. We'll consider the consent agenda, and I'd like to pull item number 360 and 367. Can you please read those items? Any other items? Good.
360, authorize a contract with the Portland Business Alliance to provide policing services for the Clean and Safe program. And 367, authorize the City Attorney's Office to amend outside legal service agreement with Littler Mendelson PC.
All right, consideration of the remaining.
I believe 360 is being set over 2 weeks.
360. Oh, sorry, you're right. That's been pulled, and we'll just bring it back to the mayor's office.
Right.
Okay. And resubmit it. So unless there are objections, 360 is sent back to the mayor's office. So any other items on the consent agenda worth noting? Can you please call the vote on the consent agenda?
Fish.
Aye.
Zaltzman.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Adams.
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. We have some time certains. Can you please read the title for time certain report, item number 354.
Accept fire and police disability and retirement report.
Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. 6 years ago, the city faced an unfunded police and fire pension liability that was projected to reach $8 billion and literally consume our city's general fund. We also faced heavy criticism about how the police and fire disability system, which was judged by many, including myself, to have little or no oversight. But in 2006, the City Council forwarded sweeping changes to the fire and police disability and retirement system to the voters, and they overwhelmingly passed those reforms. I believe it was 82% approval. Linda Jefferson took the helm of the fire, police, disability, and retirement system shortly after the reforms were enacted and built a new and improved FPDNR, literally from the ground up. Nancy Hartline, FPDNR's financial manager, has implemented an excellent system of financial controls and, in the process, uncovered financial errors which have resulted in savings for the taxpayers. Yvonne Deckard has served as the chair of the board, enacting new administrative rules to guide the reforms, and she has also graciously agreed to continue on the board as the mayor's designee, even after she retires from the city at the end of this month. So I just want to say to Yvonne, I am very grateful for your agreeing to continue to serve as chair. You will sorely be missed here in the city when you retire. And with that, I think I will turn it over first to Yvonne.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Council. For the record, my name is Yvonne Deckard, and today I'm here as in my capacity as the chair for the Board of Trustees for the FPDNR. In our January 24th meeting, Board of Trustee meeting, the fund manager, Linda Jefferson, and the fund financial manager, Nancy Hartline, reported to the Board of Trustees on the state of the FPDNR. This report covered the accomplishments made since 2007 charter change implementation to date. At the request of Commissioner Saltzman, we are here today to share those accomplishments with you, the Council. Now, at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Linda.
Thank you, Chair Deckard. I'm Linda Jefferson, the FPDR Fund Administrator. I'd like to thank you for allowing us to give you an update of our program post the 2006 reforms. And I'll just begin by sharing with you probably the most significant change to the program was that any new hires that were sworn members after January 1st, 2007 went into the Oregon PERS system for their retirement. Those individuals are still eligible for the FPDR, under the FPDR program for any disability benefits. There were truly some significant changes in making those moves, and it actually then moved from an unfunded responsibility to a pre-funded system with the Oregon PERS system. The FPDR levy does fund the PERS contributions. The levy is increasing now, as it was expected to do at the time of the ballot measure, but it will decrease in the future as FPDR pay-as-you-go pension expenses start to decline. The Board of Trustees, the number of trustees and how the board was made up also changed as a result of the reforms. There's a 5-member board now that consists of the mayor or the mayor's designee. There's an active fire member. The individual is elected by active fire members, and our current member on the board is Lieutenant Bob Lemon. Our active police member elected by the active police members is Detective Jeff Nelson. And there are two Portland citizens with pension or disability experience that are nominated by the mayor and approved by City Council. Those individuals are Justin Delaney and David Doherty. The fund administrator is a disability expert, and that was another provision of the 2006 reforms. That individual was appointed by the mayor, approved by the Board of Trustees, and then, of course, confirmed by City Council. The administrator position is also a bureau director position as a result of the forms. Previously, the FPDR program reported to the auditor's office, but now is a self-sustaining bureau. The administrator was given the authority to make decisions on all disability claims, which was also a significant change from pre-reform practices where the Board of Trustees had that responsibility. Now, if there's any appeal of a decision that is made by the administrator, rather than going to the Board of Trustees, it goes before an independent hearings officer who must be a member of the Oregon State Bar. And the individual must have a disability experience. Any further appeal beyond the hearings officer is before an independent panel of three members who also must be members of the Oregon State Bar and have disability experience. One of the other features of the reforms was the provision for FPDR to subrogate or to recover from third parties who caused injury to our members, and those injuries resulted in claims costs. Previously, FPDR could only recover medical costs. Now we can recover any disability costs that are associated with an individual who was injured on the job as a result of a third party. There was another subsequent piece that was on the November 2007 ballot that provided additional benefit to all FPDR members. Prior to this change, only members who went into retirement from disability were eligible to receive a continuation of their medical benefits post-retirement. Effective January 1st, 2007, as a result of this ballot measure passing, also service retirement individuals who had approved service-connected disability claims were eligible for a post-retirement medical benefit so long as the condition that they were being treated for was still related to their approved claim. I wanted to share that soon after starting with FPDR, I recognized that it was a program in transition and that there were a number of temporary staff who were administering the program, and some of those individuals found other employment before we were able to complete formal employment processing. But once we went through that, and it took several months to do so, one of the things that I felt was important to help in the team building process and to also to communicate to all of the stakeholders what we were about was to go through a process of developing what our mission statement was going forward, what our vision and our values were. So I just wanted to share with you what our mission statement is. The Bureau of Fire and Police Disability and Retirement administers disability, death, and retirement benefits to Portland firefighters, police officers, and their survivors. And our vision statement is to provide the best possible service to members and other stakeholders in a competent, respectful, and equitable manner. There were several directives that resulted from the charter reform. One that was fairly significant that we are still in the process of completing is to update our data records so that we could be more capable of comparing our data with other occupational disability organizations. And we, as I mentioned, we are currently in the process of doing that. And in managing the disability program, we have contracted for managed healthcare services through providers that are contracted with a network of medical managed healthcare services. That has provided cost savings. We've also contracted with a bill audit firm for doing fee schedule reductions and provider discounting. The savings has been on average 33% a month. Administrative costs for those services average about 3.5% of the savings. And then there have been additional 5.5% savings for the use of one of the contracted health care providers, provider networks, I should say. As far as our accomplishments, with the pension program, we were able to implement a federal program that provides an additional benefit to our retirees, which is an income exclusion for retiree health insurance premium payments. We make those payments directly to our retirees' supplemental health plans, their Medicare supplemental plans, on their behalf. And then at the end of the year, there's a maximum amount that is not taxable under the federal taxation program. We also identified and corrected pension benefit miscalculations that have resulted in an overpayment of benefits, and the annual savings is $0.7 million. And finally, the pension program was audited. Both the pension and the disability program have been audited during the past five-year period. We also recently, well, it was last year, underwent an audit that was conducted by the city's Audit Services Division, and they did note that there were improvements from the reform, but challenges remain. And most significant from their perspective was the city's finance, fiscal sustainability, and suggested that any actions that can be taken now can reduce future problems. So there was a recommendation that staff look at its procedures and administrative rules for opportunities at helping to contain costs, and we do that on an ongoing basis. One of the other things that I wanted to share with you this morning is that our Board of Trustees is currently working on a list of issues to be presented for your consideration of charter changes on the November 2012 ballot measure. So that information should be coming to you in the very near future. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Hartline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Hartline, FPDR Financial Manager. Like all bureaus, we look to improve our customer service to our members and their survivors. We have sought feedback from the membership, first through a pair of informal conversations with members called the FPDR Community Conversations, where we talked about the services we provide, how we provide them, and how we could work with the membership to improve those services. We also have a number of customer service surveys. We have a biennial survey, and then we have point of service surveys associated with the retirement workshops, pension estimates provided to members, and also the retirement process itself when members retire. For the pension program, we've increased the frequency of retirement workshops at the suggestion of the membership. We've added some frequently asked questions documents to the website, and we've reinstated quarterly newsletters for retirees. Initially, we sent the newsletters to all of the members, but the feedback we received from active members was that they did not read the newsletters. So at this point, we are sending them just to retirees, and we continue to work on how best to communicate with the active members. For the disability program, we've added new service-connected injury forms to the website. We've provided our disability forms to our managed health care providers to place on their physician websites so that the physicians can access the forms if the members forget to bring them to their appointments. We've also developed a quick reference piece and a laminated business card on how to access FPDR services and distributed them to the fire and police bureaus. For the disability program, our program objective is to administer claims for disability benefits in a fair and equitable manner and in compliance with the charter and the FPDR administrative rules. Over the last 5 years, we've averaged about 340 claims a year. 90% of these claims are approved, about 6% are denied, and the rest are withdrawn by the member after filing. For the last 4 years, we've seen on average 4 members a year transfer from biweekly benefits to monthly benefits, which means they have been on disability for a year at that point. This represents just over 1% of approved claims. The other almost 99% return to work, most of them to their regular duties, some to short-term limited duty assignments until they fully recover. Some of our success in returning members to work is due to our partners in the fire and police bureaus and their facilitation of return to limited duty assignments. Here you see two measurements of our disability program comparing 2006 before charter reform and last fiscal year as the most recently completed year. The chart on the left represents the percent of workforce on disability at June 30th. This measurement has declined 44% from our baseline year in 5 years. In 2006, it was 9.5% and down to 5.3% last year. Much of the decline is due to members transitioning from disability benefits to pension benefits, but as you saw in the previous slide, very few members are staying on disability more than a year now. The chart on the right represents non-medical expense as a percent of covered payroll. This has declined 41% from the baseline. It was almost 7% and is now just over 4%. In absolute terms, non-medical disability expense has decreased from $8.2 million to $5.2 million over the same period. To contain medical costs, which are by nature more volatile than the disability time loss expense, we've contracted, as Linda mentioned, with managed healthcare service providers that offer provider network fee arrangements, are experienced in treating service-connected and occupational disabilities, provide medical case management services, allow use of contracted fees with healthcare providers, and offer us access to the Oregon fee schedule to reduce medical costs. And we also have a healthcare bill audit firm, as Linda mentioned. This reduction in medical costs due to contracted providers averages a savings of about 33%. Of which the administrative costs are 3.5% of the savings, and an additional 5.5% savings for use of one of the networks. The last slide shows the history and projection of the FPDR tax levy. The placement of new hires in PERS is moving the sworn pension benefits to a pre-funded system. In the long run, this will serve to reduce pension expense and so the levy, but in the short run, it increases expense. PERS contributions paid by FPDR were $2.9 million last year. This is the fastest growing component of FPDR's budget, increasing 178% over the coming five-year plan. It will be almost $14 million in fiscal year end 2017. Higher expenses, of course, mean a higher tax levy rate until the pay-as-you-go pension benefits from the FPDR pension program begin to decline.
So, Linda, can I ask you a question about that? Isn't the maximum levy $2.80?
That's correct.
So you're actually projecting going beyond the...
The top line is the assessed value rate. The $2.80 limit is on real market value.
I see.
So that's
doesn't...
the bottom line.
Okay. So we're still within the levy.
Yes. Okay. So in terms of the assessed value rate, the top line on the graph, we've been fairly steady recently, about $2.63 per $1,000, meaning that our requirements have been growing about the same rate as assessed value, which is about 3% a year. But over the five-year plan that's coming, we project an increase to $2.96 at the end of the five-year plan. Real market rates, however, the bottom line, have been increasing as Portland's total real market value has declined in the last few years. This decline is what's causing the increased compression we're seeing on all of the tax levies. But our growing requirements is also a factor in increasing compression. We project an increase from a current rate of $1.41 to $1.93 in fiscal year end 2016. And as we've mentioned, the levy limit here is $2.80 per $1,000 of real market value. We conduct a biennial levy adequacy analysis to assess the risk of reaching that limit. In the last analysis conducted 2 years ago, we were approaching a 10% risk in 2029. The next analysis will be conducted later this year.
20% risk of breaking the levy?
10%.
A 10% risk?
Yes, of hitting the $2.80 levy limit.
10% risk.
Risk. Okay. In a Monte Carlo simulation of thousands of trials, close to 10% out in 2029 showed us exceeding the $2.80 levy limit.
But there's no projection at any point in the future of the levy being exceeded?
Well, it's a probabilistic evaluation.
No probability that it
so there is up to a 10% probability that we could.
But nothing even beyond 2029 that would indicate?
Well, that's the limit of the analysis period at this point. So it'll go out to 2031 in the next analysis. And that, we feel, is a five-year period where the levy will be at the peak.
The five-year period being 2029?
The early 2030s.
Early 2030s.
But we don't have any indication even at that point it would break the levy, all other things being equal.
The probability is 90% that we will not reach that limit. Yes.
Even beyond 2029.
Well, as I said, the estimate, the evaluation has only gone out through 2029 at this point, and we'll see it through 2031. But the plan or the expected path of our expenditures isn't the early 2030s, will be the peak point of our expenditures. And then, because most of the current membership will be retired, and those pension expenses will start declining.
They'll start declining because all
we die.
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah. Members under the pre-2006 reforms will be retired by then, is what you're saying.
Well, they'll be retired, and we'll have fewer pension payees. Right. Under that program over time.
And then PERS will be covering all of the people hired since January 1st.
Yes. Yeah. Correct.
2007.
Yes. Right. Any other questions?
Did you have anything additional you wanted to add, Devon? Okay.
No, the board is working with the staff on looking at additional, you know, charter reform that may be needed. We do have a special committee that we're putting together to deal with the solvency issue, to look closely at that in order to be on top and divert reaching that peak, or, you know, what would we do if we did reach the peak. And so we're working on what the board should do and what we should, how we should move forward with that. And so so there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, the staff has been very good in keeping the board really abreast on what those critical issues are. You know, with the addition of our new board member, who is pension expert, he's brought a lot of knowledge to the table that I think would be very helpful.
Any other questions? So we have one of the trustees in the audience, Lieutenant Bob Lemon. Did you want to say anything, Bob, or come up here? I don't know if there's any, I don't see any other trustees.
Bob Lemon, I'm the fire trustee. I'd just like to say that things are working pretty much the way they were designed in 2007. There was going to be an increase due to funding the two systems at the same time. The problem now is even all the scenarios we anticipated didn't cover what has happened, the collapse of the housing market and the financial markets. That puts a strain on the levy because the housing markets aren't going up. And when we funding the system through the OPSERP system, I don't believe anybody anticipated them going back and requiring more money to make up their financial losses from 2000 before our hirees. So we're not only paying for the people that we did hire, but we also have to pay for their financial losses prior to that. So those the combination of those two things is driving the levy up to its ceiling. We still only have a 10% chance in 2029 of it reaching the levy. So that's pretty good bet. But I guess that's in this scenario or this venue, that's significant that there's any possibility of it reaching the levy limit. I would say the other thing is that I've traveled around, and in 2007 we undertook, the associations and the council together undertook something that is being going on throughout the country now, where they're attempting to reconfigure pensions away from defined benefit to defined contributions and combinations thereof. And it's a very painful process, and we accomplished that already in 2007. We were 5 years ahead of everybody else, and anywhere you go around, they're fighting tooth and nail to do what we've already done. So we've done what needed to be done, and we have put the fund on a found, you know, solid footing for the future by pre-funding the pension, No one else has this same kind of system that we have, an unfunded system, but as it turns out, it's pretty solid when you compare it to some of the things that have happened to other systems throughout the country where they lost all their money by investing in real estate. So it's funny to talk to people, and they're going through this now, and they're fighting in the courts about it, and we already have it. So I've been able to kind of coach some people up and tell them it's better to get along than to fight it out. So
Bob, you're probably not familiar with this phenomenon, but believe it or not, sometimes elected officials distance themselves from failures and want no responsibility for it. But then when something succeeds, they want singularly all the credit for it.
I'm very familiar with
that. Oh, you are familiar with that. Okay. So I just...
other cities, of course.
Yeah. Well, I didn't say that. So just to be clear, you representing the firefighters participated fully in the development of the charter changes. You endorsed them, and in fact, supported them passing.
Yes, and they reflect- I believe that's why it passed both 80% is because there was no opposition. The associations were full partners in the creation of this new system.
And it wasn't any one person's proposal. It was a combination of compromises and hard work and give and take. And the result is you sitting here now telling us that you're going to other cities helping
them.
Are
you saying I was taking credit for it?
No, I'm not.
They did call it Plan B because I did kind of come up with the new configuration of the board at the time.
Right.
No, there was it took 7 months of rooms full of people.
Right.
And
I knew that, but I wanted to make sure everybody understood that this was not something that was forced on you.
Mr. King and I agonized over this for a long time, but we decided that that was the right thing to do because
Robert King, the then president of the police union. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Good work.
Everybody signed up?
Carl, anyone signed up?
No one else signed up.
Does anyone wish to testify on this matter? I'll entertain a motion to accept.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept this report. Carla, can you please call the vote on the motion to accept the report?
Fish?
Thank you for your good work and an outstanding report. And to all of those who are making this work, and Commissioner Saltzman, you have our thanks. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, the results we have seen today, creating a more professional disability system and a more financially sound pension system, would not be possible were it not for the three women who just presented this report. And as Commissioner Leonard and Trustee Lemon are pointing out, it would also not have been possible if it hadn't been for the arduous work of a committee of stakeholders, and including the City Club, who worked for 7 months to come up with the charter reforms. And I just wanted to single out Shannon Callahan on my own staff, who really participated actively in that committee and in drafting the reforms and making everything fit in the ballot measures, because as everybody can tell just from the briefing, it's a very complicated area. And so I just want to thank Shannon Callahan of the office, too, for her past work and continuing work. Aye.
Leonard?
Well, and I, too, want to acknowledge the work of all of the folks that Commissioner Saltzman has identified, but especially the men and women of the Portland Police Bureau and the Portland Fire Bureau, who, had they not participated fully and been empowered to participate fully and been heard when they raised objections, none of the changes would have been possible. So I want to greatly acknowledge their involvement and appreciate everybody's work on this. Aye.
Fritz.
This is a great example of participatory democracy with lots of people at the table figuring out the best outcomes for the benefit for the pension earners and also for the taxpayers. I particularly thank Yvonne Deckard for her work and for agreeing to continue to serve on the committee. Your leadership is greatly needed, ongoing, and I thank you for all of your work. And Commissioner Saltzman, you have been the champion on the council to continue to look over this. I'm looking forward to the additional charter changes that might be forthcoming, and I appreciate everybody's willingness to work together on this. Aye.
Adams.
Thank you to everyone involved, all the stakeholders, police, fire, the staff. We had some outside consultants as well. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, for your leadership, and Commissioner Leonard for your leadership as well and partnership on this issue. You know, 44% reduction in police and fire disability cases. Who would have imagined? Congratulations. Aye. Motion is approved. Can you please read the title for report, item number 355.
Accept 2-year progress report for the Joint City of Portland-Multnomah County Climate Action Plan.
Would staff please come forward? And then also read 356.
Accept the Willamette Valley Resilience Compact and authorize joining other Willamette Valley jurisdictions to collaborate on climate change adaption.
Well, I'm very pleased to bring back to council the report
from our climate action strategy. That's a partnership between the City of Portland, Multnomah County, other private, public, and nonprofit and advocacy organizations. This City Council, through the collective work of this City Council and the bureaus that they oversee, we've been able to accomplish something that few other cities have been able to accomplish. We've seen a significant reduction in real, in actual terms of greenhouse gas emissions, and at the same time while adding jobs and seeing a recovering economy.